From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the 114th Congress begins with both the House and Senate controlled by the GOP. Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee has a challenge to his fellow Democrats.
My caution to my own colleagues is to not take this moment as an opportunity to simply be the party of no.
Body cameras for police officers.
The cameras will help those of us that do a good job kind of push the bad cops out of the business.
But what might happen to the video from those cameras? Plus, new technology on display at the Consumer Electronics Show gives us a peek at the cars of the future.
Self-parking systems that would be able to drop you off at your destination, and then the vehicle itself would go find a parking space.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Body cameras on police officers.
The cameras will help those of us that do a good job kind of push the bad cops out of the business.
But one police chief is warning what might happen to those public record videos.
We could have a situation where we have several companies calling and mining this data where they're going to make a show and, you know, it could be America's most drunk.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the implications of body cameras for cops. But first, the 114th Congress begins today. Congressman Dan Kildee is with us now from Capitol Hill. He, of course, is the Democratic representative from Flint. Welcome, Congressman.
Thanks. It's good to be back on.
You and I have talked on this show a lot about the terrible approval ratings that Congress has and how fed up the public is with gridlock and that hyper-partisan atmosphere on the Hill. I'm wondering, what do you think the prospects are for the 114th Congress to, I don't know, frankly, do better than the 113th?
Well, it remains to be seen. The first few votes look like it's going to be a replay of the 113th Congress. You know, another vote to essentially repeal the Affordable Care Act, another vote on the Keystone Pipeline. It's possible that those votes are just going to allow the Republican leadership to satisfy the new members who want to be able to express themselves on those sort of almost theatrical votes that will take place. The question is then whether or not they will turn to real legislating. If they do, we have a chance to get things done. As you said, people are frustrated with Congress. The low approval rating is earned. But I think it would be a mistake for the Republicans to misread the result of the 2014 elections as some sort of an endorsement or mandate for their ideological agenda. My read of the frustration is that people just want to see us take on these big questions that the country faces and get our work done. We can do that with a Republican majority. I would prefer a Democratic majority. But there isn't anything about the Republicans being in charge that should prevent us from working to solve these big questions. And the Democrats can't use our minority status as an excuse for not participating in the legislative process.
Good point, which makes me wonder, what will it look like on the ground level? How would you and other Democratic lawmakers advance your bills and your causes past that Republican majority?
Well, if we can get back to what had long been the norm in Congress, no matter who was in charge, there were procedures that allowed for thoughtful amendments to be considered by the whole House. What we've seen in the last 2 years, and just at least in the 2 years that I've been here, is the Republican majority in the House using the rules, I think abusing the rules of the House, to prevent us from offering amendments and then getting a yes or no vote. The reason that's so important is that if we can get our ideas considered by the House, I think what we would find is that there's much more agreement across party lines on some of the approaches that we want to take to these big challenges than are ever allowed to be manifest in votes that we take, not because we don't agree, but because those votes are never held. The rules of the House determine whether or not we can offer amendments. And that's been the biggest frustration, is that we're not in the driver's seat, for sure. We know that. But we ought to be able to offer our suggestions. And if the House agrees, accept them. And if they don't, reject them. That had been the norm here for so long. And then just over the last few years, we've seen that the rules of the House have been used to prevent the voices of the minority from being considered in the legislative process.
What makes you think it'll be different, that you might be able to kind of go back to the way things were instead of keeping things, as you say, you feel like it was slanted in the way the rules were used? What makes you think it'll change?
I don't know that it will, but I'm hopeful that it might. And of course, I'd prefer the shoe to be on the other foot. But the truth of the matter is now, The Senate is now under Republican control. So many of the concerns that more ideological members of the House on the Republican side had about allowing amendments to the floor was basically they were concerned that the Senate would accept the language that Democrats were proposing and then they would lose control over the agenda. Hmm. They no longer have to worry about the Senate undoing the work of the House. Both bodies are run by the same party. So it does give them, the Republican leadership, the freedom to be more bipartisan than they had when they were always concerned about basically handing over to the Senate the keys to the Congress. They don't have to worry about that any longer. There's an opportunity that they have to reach across party lines, and it's going to be up to them to determine whether they want to do that. I will say, at least for my part and for most of the members of the Democratic caucus, we are willing and ready to work in a bipartisan fashion. We just need the opportunity.
You mentioned, Congressman Kildee, about that if resolutions and ideas can be discussed and talked about, that there's a much better chance of seeing bipartisan agreement. Does that door swing the other way as well? Does a Democratic Congress see common ground with the Republicans?
I think we do. My caution to my own colleagues is to not take this moment as an opportunity to simply be the party of no. We actually have to be open to the ideas that the Republican conference will offer and not just be a knee-jerk, negative, sort of anti-party. I think if we take that approach, we send a message to them that we can work with them. Like many of the issues we need to take on really don't have strong ideological foundations. For example, we need an infrastructure bill desperately in this country. We need to rebuild our roads, our bridges, our rail, our ports. That is not a partisan question. I've never seen a Democratic road or a Republican road. We need to do that. And historically, transportation bills have been bipartisan. That's one of those issues that ought to transcend partisanship. We should and absolutely need to take up.
Looking ahead to the next 2 years, Congressman, what's on your agenda? What's most important to you and bills you're preparing or issues that you really feel are the most important?
Well, I mean, one of the big issues for me will be the federal budget and trying to make sure that the priorities that are manifest in the federal budget are consistent with the needs of the people that I represent. So I want to focus on supporting higher education, making college more affordable, supporting the redevelopment of older industrial cities. I mean, my principal agenda for this term going forward will be to try to get federal policy for America's cities regenerated, realigned with the needs of those older cities that have struggled in the transition from the old to the new economy. And there's all sorts of ways that we'll approach that. But it's primarily trying to get Congress to take on these big questions, immigration reform, tax reform, infrastructure investment, try to move the ball forward and, you know, do it in a bipartisan fashion. That's going to be my goal.
Have you had conversations with the new Michigan members of the House? And I'm particularly wondering if you've had a chance to talk with Republicans Mike Bishop and Dave Trott and John Molinar. Do you think these are people willing to, you know, look for a bipartisan consensus?
I think so. And, you know, while we do have ideological differences, I'm going to be visiting all three of their offices today. I have particularly sought out John Molinar because he and I have a long shared district boundary and we share Saginaw County. And I've known John for some time. And despite the fact that we probably do have different political philosophies, we have pledged to one another that we're going to continue the same kind of a relationship that Dave Camp and I had, his predecessor. I think in Michigan, we have a special responsibility for bipartisanship because there are unique Michigan interests that will only be served if the Michigan delegation works together. Two that come to mind immediately are the protection and support of the American auto industry, and secondly, the Great Lakes. Those issues generally transcend partisanship, and it's really important for this new Michigan delegation to make an early statement that when it comes to issues that are particular to Michigan, party stands aside, and we stand for our state first and foremost.
New faces are coming in for their first day today as members of the United States Congress. And I'm wondering if you'll take us back 2 years ago when you sat down at that desk as a brand new congressman. You, of course, succeeded your uncle, who'd represented Flint in Congress for 36 years. So you grew up close to Congress, but now you were the one they're calling congressman. What was that like?
You know, I think about that day, and today I'm sort of going through the paces all over again, and it reminds me of just exactly how overwhelming it was. I have to admit that today I have sort of that same excitement, only this time I'm not a freshman. I will not get lost on the way to the floor of the House. I'll know my way. I know most of the members now. But it's that same sense of wonder and amazement and just being so much aware of the honor that the people of my district have given me by allowing me to represent them. You know, it's difficult to not be a little bit emotional when I consider the history of this Congress and the fact that I get to play a little bit of role in creating history for future generations.
I'm wondering what do's and don'ts you might share with Michigan's freshmen, with Brenda Lawrence, Dave Trott, Debbie Dingell, John Molinar, and Mike Bishop. What would you share with them?
Well, I think the one big thing is to take care of yourself. This job can be absolutely overwhelming, and I'm almost back to my pre-2012 election weight. You know, you've got to take care of your physical and mental health. You have to be able to pace yourself and manage your schedule and rely on very well-qualified, hardworking, smart staff people. You can't do it all yourself. It's just an overwhelming job. The other, I guess, piece of advice is we have to be willing and able and ready to weigh in on lots of issues all across the policy spectrum. But to find that one thing that you can really provide some expertise on and try to own that particular issue, that to me, the successful members of Congress are able to find that one thing where they become the go-to person. For me, it's the regeneration of America's older cities. For somebody else, it might be another issue. That is advice that I got in the last 2 years. I have found exactly how important that advice was.
Democrat Dan Kildee, Congressman from Michigan's 5th District, on this, the opening day, opening session of the 114th Congress. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Every year, the Word Warriors of Wayne State University, yes, that's the name of the group, they come out with a list of the top 10 vintage words that deserve to be spoken and written more often. Chris Williams is with Wayne State University in Detroit. Chris, we tend to overuse new words like selfie and hashtag, but these are old words that have fallen by the wayside?
Right. These are words that were popular decades, even centuries ago, that have fallen out of use, and we think they would enrich people's conversation and their writing. It makes it so much more fun to say these words than to, you know, just go back to the old standards.
So the Word Warriors are hoping we'll all show a little love to some venerable and interesting old words.
Absolutely.
How did you land on these 10 words?
But these words are submitted by people across the world on our website, which is wordwarriors.wayne.edu. They can nominate the words at any time, and we go through and we pick one each week, and we put it up on our Facebook site, we put it up on the website, and people can go through and they can comment on it, they can vote on it, and the ones that we see that are gaining the most traction, we kind of set aside, and at the end of the year, we go back and we talk about what are the 10 that really gained the most traction, that really stood out and were unique, and that we just think are the richest words to use in your writing and in your vocabulary every day.
So looking at this, the latest list of the top 10 words that we should be using more often, what's your personal favorite?
I love flapdoodle.
Me too.
That is a great word because as soon as someone says, oh, that's just a bunch of flapdoodle, you don't even need a definition. It's nonsense. You know exactly what it is.
And that goes from the late 1800s, if I recall from my American history classes.
Yes, yes.
You've got a word on there that I happen to love is rapscallion, which goes back to, the 1600s, I think.
That's a nice and old one, and yet it's still just a perfect word. I have a toddler at home, and he is a rapscallion. He is always into something, and you know, before we even saw it submitted for this list, that was a word that I used for him all the time.
And I would suspect also, if you have a toddler, the word caterwaul comes into mind.
it does. It comes from him, and then sometimes it comes from us. So,
And define that for us.
A caterwaul is a shrill howling or wailing noise. So he can caterwaul for a few hours before we start caterwauling.
Now, there were a couple of words on the list that I have to say, I kind of pride myself on being pretty good with vocabulary. I had never heard the word obamulate until now, and I know it has nothing to do with President Obama.
No, and you know, when I first saw it, that was my first thought, too. I had never heard that word, but that's where my mind went right away, and then I looked it up, and it sounds like such a nice, relaxing word, too. You wake up, you obambulate around a beach if you're on vacation. It's just a nice, relaxing word.
And a word that I think a lot of us have never heard, but it makes such sense when you define it, because so many of us drive through miles of this, is subtopia.
Yes, there has so much use today. I actually thought this was a newer word when it was submitted because it just seems to define everything that's going on around major cities these days. And then I looked it up, and it's actually from the 50s people were using this word.
And what would it mean?
It's a monotonous urban sprawl of standardized buildings. So it's when you drive through and you just see the same pharmacies and the same strip malls over and over. You're in the middle of a subtopia right there.
Yeah, I think a lot of us could say that. So what had been maybe a lovely little small town has become a subtopia.
Right.
Knavery sounds very, very Shakespearean.
Yeah, that's another good one, too. That is that's one of my favorites as well. It's one that until people started submitting it, I knew I had heard it, but I hadn't heard it used a lot. And it a lot of these words, people submit them and we'll just think right away, I do like that word. Why don't people use that more? And knavery is just so great for, when you want to talk about someone who's just always getting into some trouble. A lot of rapscallions engage in a lot of knavery.
There you go. And rediscovering these words for conversation and writing really would make it richer and more fun, wouldn't it?
It would. You turn on the TV and people are using the same new phrases and everything seems just, I don't know, very vapid when people are using these new words like selfie and tweep, which they're great because it means our culture is constantly changing and we're constantly coming up with new words to describe a culture that's always changing. But when you look back at these words, these are where a lot of our roots are. Mm-hmm. These just have a great feel to them when you use them, you sound a little bit smarter, but it's also just there's a poetry to them. And knowing when to use them in the right way, it just makes your writing so much better. It makes your vocabulary so much better.
You can study up on this list from the Wayne State Word Warriors by going to wordwarriors.wayne.edu. Chris Williams is with Wayne State University. Good talking with you, Chris. And you are not a Philistine.
I am not a Philistine. I am not.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much.
In the battle against cancer, patients and their physicians can really pull out all the stops: surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy. If all goes as planned, the patient goes into remission and gets back to his or her life. But what about the physical toll of all these cancer therapies, treatments that are inherently toxic? My next guest is a physician. She's an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and she's a breast cancer survivor. She's come up with a program of cancer rehabilitation and prehabilitation. Dr. Julie Silver, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here today.
What is cancer rehabilitation, and why is it so important for cancer survivors?
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here today.
What is cancer rehabilitation, and why is it so important for cancer survivors?
Cancer rehabilitation actually isn't new. The idea of rehabilitation in general is very well established. For example, people who have strokes or in car accidents, they would get physical therapy or speech therapy, and sometimes they would see a physiatrist, a doctor like me that specializes in rehabilitation medicine. And for whatever reason, we haven't really established that throughout the cancer care continuum. And the irony is actually that a lot of people, we're so good at screening tests that a lot of people get their cancer picked up on a screening test and they actually feel really good going into cancer treatment and then feel terrible at the end.
I want to know what happened with your cancer experience that led you to realize that this gap existed.
I was in my 30s when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I felt fantastic going into treatment. I had three little kids at home that depended on me. I was a busy doctor. I was a mother, a daughter, a sister, a wife, all of those different roles. And as I went through treatment, I got really, really, really sick. And at the end of my treatment, my last chemotherapy, I said to my oncologist, "What do I do now?" And he said, "Well, try to heal. And someday, if you can, try to go back to work." And I sat there and I thought, wow, I love my oncologist. I thought I had great care, but I thought, this is not okay. I cannot be expected to heal on my own and figure this all out and potentially live with permanent disability for the rest of my life that I don't need to necessarily have.
So you said, all right, you are a rehab physical medicine and rehabilitation physician. Let's tackle this. What kinds of treatment-related impairments are we talking about?
Well, probably the one that people think of the most is lymphedema. But lymphedema is actually something that is important, but most cancer survivors don't have lymphedema. So we don't want to equate lymphedema as a synonym for cancer rehab in general. There's a lot of impairments that, and I love it that you use the word impairments because we really do want to focus on impairments that cancer survivors may have. They may have an amputation. They may have surgery that cuts muscles and skin and, can be tendons, ligaments, all kinds of tissues that need to heal and would typically get rehab if they had back surgery or whatever it is. But in cancer, we might do major surgeries, repositioning muscles, for example, in breast reconstructions and all kinds of things like that, where these patients have pretty significant impairments. They might have neuropathy from chemotherapy. They could have a frozen shoulder. They might not be able to turn their neck very well, and that would impair driving. That's particularly common in head and neck cancer survivors.
Also, there's chemo brain. We've heard that. Is this part of that as well?
Chemo brain is part of that, and that is what we technically call mild cognitive impairment. So mild cognitive impairment is very similar to what you would expect from a concussion. Most people think of concussions in sports. They know that when somebody has a concussion as a sports injury, that their thinking isn't real clear, that they might have some problems with memory and concentration and attention. And even though the injury is different, so that, football player gets a concussion, which is different than chemotherapy giving mild cognitive impairment, the result is pretty similar in that they have these cognitive issues that keep them from functioning at a level that they need to function at.
And you've come up not only with the idea of cancer rehab, but also, and I found this term fascinating, cancer prehab. What is that?
Cancer prehabilitation is really derived from the scientific literature that we've done in orthopedics and other types of conditions for many years, where we try to prepare people for an upcoming stressor. So if we know that they're going to have surgery, for example, we'll get them ready for it. And in cancer, what we try to do is use that window of time, and that's a hallmark of prehab, which is you use whatever window of time there is before your treatment starts to get physically and emotionally as ready as possible.
And then you build in the multidisciplinary approach. So this is not just between the patient and their oncologist.
That's right. It's a multidisciplinary approach, and in STAR programs, which STAR programs are a certification for hospitals and cancer centers, which a number of hospitals in Michigan have adopted. So in STAR programs, there's really five components to prehab, and one of those is going to be general exercise to just get somebody ready with in terms of their strength and endurance and so on. Another one would be targeted exercise. For example, in lung cancers, it would be the respiratory muscles. In prostate cancer survivors, it would be the pelvic floor muscles for urinary incontinence. For head and neck cancer survivors, it would be swallowing exercises. And then we would add a nutritional component. We would add a psychosocial component, trying to get them ready in terms of developing a coping skill that's very specific, like meditation or guided imagery, something to decrease their distress as they're going through surgery. And then if they smoke, we would do a smoking cessation, quitting smoking protocol that basically is designed to help them get through their surgery better, because we know that smokers tend to have more problems with surgery, pneumonia, difficulty weaning off the ventilator, wound infections, and so on.
The big question many people are going to, who are listening to us talking about, are going to wonder about, are these services covered by health insurance?
In general, these services are covered by health insurance. Of course, people do have co-pays.
Sure.
And if you don't have insurance, that's always a problem. But in general, these services are covered by health insurance, similar to what would happen if you were injured in a car accident or you had a stroke. Your insurance would typically cover your rehab.
Now, you've said the cancer prehab actually can increase treatment options. How is that?
That's really interesting. I was just talking to a patient who had that happen. And what had happened to her, she was 75 years old, and she was diagnosed with lung cancer. And it was an early stage lung cancer, and she was supposed to have surgery. But she had just had back surgery about 5 months earlier, and she was still trying to recover from back surgery. And she was very deconditioned. Her endurance was low. And her oncologist, her thoracic surgeon, actually said to her, I really feel as though if I operate on you, you're going to end up in a nursing home and you may never return home. And she said, that's all I needed to hear. As soon as he said I would end up in a nursing home, I said to myself, I'm going to do whatever he recommends. So he sent her to a STAR program, and she worked on really building up her strength and stamina, and he wanted her to do this for about a month prior to surgery. And she did that, and she went through surgery and did really, really well. And he came into her room, and this is what she was telling me. He came into her room right after surgery, and he said, you know, you're a superstar. And she said, he was so proud of me. I was really happy for her and for her team and her STAR program. And she said, I didn't end up in a nursing home. In fact, I was supposed to be in the hospital for 5 days, and he discharged me after 2 days. And I went home, and I did great, and I had some more rehab. And I feel better now after cancer treatment than I did before.
It just seems that you can't begin to describe the improvement in the post-treatment life of these patients that have had not just the STAR prehab, but then the post-treatment rehab.
That's exactly right. I mean, surgery really probably wouldn't have been an option for her. Mm-hmm. The surgeon was very worried about operating on her, so it opened up a treatment option. And not only did it open up a treatment option, but imagine that someone is diagnosed with cancer, and at the end of it, they actually feel physically better than they did before it. That's a real paradigm shift in how we think about cancer.
Have you been able to do studies? Have you been doing this long enough in order to do studies that can prove, you know, scientifically, that this is really making a difference?
There are studies that are coming out. One recently came out of Montreal that looked at colorectal cancer survivors, and they used a three-prong approach where they did the counseling and the psychosocial piece, where they did an intervention to try to decrease stress. And they did the nutritional intervention, and then they did the general exercise intervention. And they found that their patients did much better with the prehab and the rehab combined than just the rehab after. And that really is one of a number of studies that have come out, but this one was very recent, where people said, wow, getting started early really does make a difference. And you really do need both very often, because these are big surgeries, and then it's followed by chemotherapy or radiation. It's a lot for someone to go through, whether you're in your 30s like I was, or whether you're in your 70s like the patient I was just talking about.
How do survivors and their docs find out more about the STAR program prehab and also the rehab?
They can go on the website, oncologyrehabpartners.com, or you can simply Google STAR program and cancer and find the website. There's about 9 programs right now in Michigan, and these programs are in lots of different cities, and it's really exciting to see Michigan getting so involved. These programs are growing, so some of these have just started, some of them are expanding their services and so on, but over the next few months and over the next few years, you're going to see Michigan really doing a great job leading the STAR program.
Dr. Julie Silver, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Consumer Electronics Show gets underway today in Las Vegas. Got 4 days of companies showing off thousands and thousands of new consumer electronics products. Among those companies, automakers. This year, the auto industry will be showing off the technology that could well become an integral part of everyday driving. Paul Eisenstein is publisher of the Detroit Bureau, and Paul's with us now from Las Vegas. Hello, Paul. Welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you.
Are we talking connected cars? Are we talking about ways for drivers to enhance their driving experience through internet, sound, video, or all of the above?
All of the above and more. Ooh. We're talking about everything from touchless displays that seem to come out of sci-fi movies like Minority Report, that Tom Cruise adventure of a while back, touchless charging systems where you don't have to plug a cord into your electric vehicles. We're talking about self-parking systems that would be able to drop you off at your destination, and then the vehicle itself would go find a parking space. And then there's an all-new autonomous vehicle where you would basically just be able to spend your time inside. Well, let's say you had a couple of passengers with you. You could turn your seat around and actually have a conversation as if you were in your living room rather than your automobile.
This idea of the connected cars, and we have had various folks on stateside, including from the University of Michigan, who are doing tests with that. And the one thing that comes up is I think most of us think, really, I don't want to be the guinea pig that finds out it doesn't work as I get flattened by a semi.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is a concern that a lot of people have about whether technology will work. Will we be able to have our car drive autonomously and feel safe behind? Well, you wouldn't be behind the wheel necessarily. The wheel might be deactivated. But here's the thing. We are seeing, what, 35,000 people killed a year in automobiles. The vast, vast, vast majority come from driver error. And the new technology, using a variety of sensors, laser, radar, cameras, sonar, and more, preliminary tests show that they would probably be significantly safer than having the driver operating the vehicle. So the goal, in fact, is that this autonomous technology, such as is used in the F015 luxury in motion concept that we saw debuted last night by Mercedes, would actually result in safer, faster travel, and also would result in improved fuel economy.
And how likely is it that this technology will get into, we'll call them real world, real people cars?
Very likely. In fact, Cadillac is set to deliver what it's calling its Super Drive, which will allow you essentially to drive on a limited access highway, a freeway, hands-free within about 2 years. And then we have Nissan, which is supposed to be adding a fully autonomous vehicle by about 2020. So all these technologies are coming very real. And there's all sorts of touch displays and touchless displays that we're likely to see at home. But heck, there we have that stuff in the home already. Look at the Microsoft Kinect system on their Xbox, which allows you to play video games without having a controller in your hand.
Have automakers learned a lesson or two from what happened with Ford with that MyTouch? Because that really was very hard for consumers to work.
Yeah, no question about it. That's one of the challenges that manufacturers have to deal with. It's all well and good to put technology in the car for technology's sake, but they also have to make sure that people want that technology and that it's fun and easy to work with. What I found interesting was this VW Golf R Touch concept that was being introduced at CES this week. This car, actually, it's a misnomer. It says the Golf R Touch, but it's really touchless. It uses a stereo camera system to watch where your hand is going. So something like that movie Minority Report I mentioned. Mm-hmm. If you say you wanted to change the volume or something, it would know when your hand is reaching for the volume control, and it would automatically, simply by a gesture, let you change how loud the stereo is. And if you weren't sure what it was doing, you could set it so it shows a ghost image like your hand was actually moving the controls.
Amazing things coming and all being shown at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, where we've been hearing from Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the Detroit Bureau. Paul, thank you so much.
Hey, it's good to be with you, Cynthia.
The police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the death of Eric Garner as he was arrested in New York City has certainly fired up the national conversation about body cameras for cops. Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, and Lowell in Kent County are all beginning to outfit their officers with body cameras. Grand Rapids police are seriously considering them. But there are a host of challenging privacy issues that are being uncorked here. David Oliver is chief of the Brinfield, Ohio Police Department. The chief recently went on Facebook and posted an open letter about police body cameras, a letter that caught our eye. Chief, welcome to Stateside.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Does this movement toward body cameras, does this feel like a natural progression in policing in the 21st century?
You know, yes, it does. This was the direction I think most police leaders saw the profession going, at least probably for the last 6 to 8 years. I mean, obviously it started with cameras in the vehicles, and you know, and back in my day that started with the old VHS tapes, and now those are all digital. So yeah, I think it was a natural progression.
And your department uses them?
We actually are putting them in service in 2015. We have one test model now. We've actually gone through a couple to figure out which one we wanted.
So before we get into your thoughts about the merits and the risks of these body cams, tell us a little how they work. How are they worn?
Well, it depends on what model you buy. Some of them can clip to a uniform shirt. There's one model that actually fits over the ear, similar to a Bluetooth. And that way you can see what the officer sees. If you're in any kind of encounter or even a conversation, if you have a forward-facing that's clipped to a uniform shirt, the officer can turn his or her head and look in a different direction, but the camera still focuses straight ahead. Because, you know, unless you turn the body, the camera's not moving with it. So I think at least on our end, we're going to be going with something that gives you the point of view of the officer no matter which way his or her head turns.
And I'm curious, just with the model that you've decided is best for your department in Brimfield, how wide is the lens? I'm wondering how much of the scene is captured, and also how clear are the audio and video images?
Both actually very good considering the size of the camera. And, you know, with today's technology, I mean, if you look at nanny cams and things like that that are put inside of a teddy bear or a stuffed animal, or even in the cameras that are located in some folks' homes for security purposes with an alarm system or something like that, the technology is definitely there. So the picture is going to be relatively clear, certainly based on the distance from the subject, and I mean subject as in not a person, but whatever you're taping. And the sound, I think, will be decent quality, too, at least on the models that we've done demos with.
And how do they run? And by that, I mean, do they run constantly, and or are they turned on?
Yeah, they have to be activated by the officer, which, you know, there's several things. First of all, I am very pro-camera for law enforcement. I believe that it is going to clear up immensely the officer complaints that have to be investigated and through a long investigation are deemed to be without merit. I think a video will clear that up in 30 or 40 seconds now. So,
yeah.
You know, you won't have these long, drawn-out investigations with interviewing people. You bring in a video, you download it, and a chief or command staff or internal affairs, depending on how big the department is, would look at the video and say, yes, this happened, or no, it didn't.
In fact, you write about that in your Facebook post. Would you give us kind of recap that? For instance, you had a complaint that came from a domestic incident.
Yeah, we did. We actually had a young man, well, he was overage, but a younger male was arrested for a domestic incident and made some allegations against one of my officers, to the point where he said that he was struck and he was called names and some other things. And then his father became involved and couldn't believe that we treated his son in such a way. The issue that we had was we had dash cam, which recorded the interaction in the front yard, and then we had holding cell cameras. All of our holding cells and booking area are all camered also. And the two points he made the allegations about were both covered by camera, and when I called them in to close out the investigation, all I had to do was press play. And we were only into it about 60 seconds before the young man asked us to stop. He said, I don't want my dad to see this. And so, you know, for me, that was a perfect situation because I think most people will find out that well over 95-98% of police officers do a great job, and the cameras will help those of us that do a good job kind of push the bad cops out of the business, and they will protect the large majority that really come to work every day and do a great job.
Then the ACLU, for instance, agrees with you, saying these cameras can be win-win as they help protect police against the false accusations and then help protect the public against police misconduct. So, and as you say, I love body cameras. They help me do a better job. But let's get into your thoughts that you express about the price we're paying in lost privacy.
Well, I think the people who are going to have the toughest time with these cameras is the public. I think the public is going to be in for a rude awakening when perhaps they live in a neighborhood where they have some neighbors who they aren't very friendly with, and we get called to their house for a domestic or for a neighborhood dispute or whatever. When we get out of the car, at least in our department, our officers, they're going to be mandated when you're dealing, talking with anybody, you press record. And I think that it takes some of the anonymity out of complaints, and I also think that it will open up an entire public records door that has never been opened before. If you have somebody in your neighborhood who is, I mean, in my day we used to say nosy, but
yeah.
Very curious about things that go on, all they have to do is come to the police department and request the video for that incident, and they'll be able to watch it.
You have to provide that video.
We do. It's public record. Mm. There will be some exceptions, and probably the exception was that I can see forthcoming through legislative means would be sexual assault victims and juveniles. I think there'll be a shield on those. But, you know, in a domestic situation, we could walk in and have a pretty heated, let's just use a generic example where we have a couple of intoxicated people who can't get along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to go in and press play, and they're going to be in all their glory with, you know, throwing comments around and insults and everything else. And when that case closes out, all of it's public record, including the recording. So not only will you have what they said maybe when they weren't at their best, but you're going to have the interior of their home. You're going to have, you know, everything else that's involved with it.
So, yeah, when you think about it, it's one thing to have that dash cam recording a traffic stop along I-75.
That's
it's
correct.
Quite another to have it rolling in my living room.
And for me, that's, I know there's a big public push right now for the cameras. And as I put on our Facebook page, the Brimfield PD page, I said, you got to be careful what you ask for, because with all of, and I don't want to say places like NPR or reputable news sources, but when you have people out there who make their existence on footage like this, you know, the true show kind of things,
mm-hmm.
We could be looking at blanket public records requests for all the videos for the month of December from your body cameras. And then you I'm not a doom and gloomer here, but I could see it happening based on the fact that it would sell. And we all know that when it makes money, you know, it usually is put on the market.
Yes.
And we have a situation where we could have a situation where we have several companies calling and mining this data in a situation where they're going to make a show. And, you know, it could be America's Most Drunk or America's Most Whatever. And we have people that are at their worst, and in any other arena, we never would have captured it on video. But with the push going this direction, it's a very, very real possibility.
And what are the privacy issues that are raised for your officers?
I don't worry about the privacy issues so much. I mean, we're public officials. When we're out in the public, everything we do is not only unless it's an ongoing investigation, it's not public record, but it's certainly for all public consumption, either at the end of the investigation or even while we're in the middle of it. I mean, people routinely videotape us every time, and I mean us in the profession. If police go out on a call that is pretty heated, it's not uncommon to see 11 or 12 cell phones pop out and the recording start. We're used to that. But I think the American public is not used to it. I think that when someone calls the police and they need help and we show up and we're recording, and we're going to record to protect ourselves, but we also look for things like excited utterances where somebody's going to confess to a crime right on video. And when that investigation is done, it's going to be public record. And I think that's going to be shocking to a lot of people. And I also think it can be, for people who have not so good intentions, it could be, when, you know, I mentioned one of the things, divorce cases and things like that. If you're in a heated custody battle and we show up because you're intoxicated or whatever and your children are at home, you run the risk of your ex-spouse issuing public records requests for that and taking you back into court and pressing play for the judge in the probate court. So There's a whole lot of things that I think that the public hasn't really thought about. They want to fix a problem, and we were going to body cameras anyway. That's not the issue. But I thought, if we ever didn't go, it was going to be because of public outcry for privacy. But we seem to be ignoring that now and going a direction where, well, we have to make sure our police are held accountable. Well, I get that. Most of us are accountable. And most of us are very, very good at what we do and love the profession.
As you tell us you're in favor of body cameras for police and that it helps you do a better job, you also are saying to the public, welcome to the future, make sure you're presentable for TV. Are you saying that you wish it had not come to this point where police and the public want these cameras to protect each side from the other?
Yeah, I like them. I can't stress that enough. I like them for evidence purposes. I like them for clarity on complaints. I am very, very pro-camera. But I'm kind of bewildered because I always thought with the push that we have had maybe in the last 10 to 15 years about personal rights and about privacy, and you have things like the NSA listening to telephone calls and you know, all the other stuff that people are complaining about. In this situation, I thought it was awfully knee-jerk to make this huge push for body cameras for cops all over the United States without thinking of the fact that when you call the police, we're going to show up and you're going to be recorded. We have to look at these privacy issues, too, because Americans are kind of spoiled. We like our privacy.
Yes.
And, you know, now that another government entity has the potential to come into your house and you're going to be recorded and other people could possibly see it through a public records request, I'm bewildered that everybody maybe hasn't thought of this.
And it also kind of raises that maybe it's a deeper issue, but the idea or the feeling that police departments and the public are not on the same page as much as perhaps they used to be.
Well, I think we are. I think there are other underlying social issues that need addressed, but they're kind of being put in a backpack and being made to be carried by law enforcement. I think there are far more important and ranging issues than the 0.17% of deadly forces that are used in 12 million arrests a year. I mean, we have 12 million arrests a year, not us, but I mean, law enforcement has roughly 12 million arrests a year, and we have roughly 400 deadly force claims a year out of those 12 million. I think there's an underlying social problem, but I don't think it should be put on the back of law enforcement.
Chief David Oliver of the Brimfield, Ohio Police Department. His post is on the police Facebook page for Brimfield, Ohio. Chief, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.